This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Lebanon's embattled leadership under fire after a massive explosion destroyed large parts of central Beirut faced public fury Thursday and stern calls to reform from the visiting French president and the IMF. Reuters' Adam Reed has more.
Facing devastation, help is arriving in Lebanon. These emergency aid flights from Italy and Russia touching down in Beirut, carrying medical personnel and supplies less than 2 days after a catastrophic explosion leveled the city's port area and destroyed large sections of the Lebanese capital. French President Emmanuel Macron also arrived Thursday, promising to help organize international efforts whilst warning Lebanon's authorities that they need to address the corruption within.
That is Reuters' Adam Reed reporting. The top U.S. envoy for Iran, Brian Hook, is leaving his post, and Elliot Abrams, the U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela, will add Iran to his role following a transition period with Hook. That's according to U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Hook's surprise departure comes at a critical time when Washington has been intensely lobbying at the United Nations to extend an arms embargo on Iran, and as the UN Security Council prepares to hold a vote on the U.S. resolution next week. Iraq says Thursday it would make an additional cut in its oil production of about 400,000 barrels per day in August to compensate for its overproduction over the past period under the OPEC nations' Reduction Pact. Iraq says the oil output cut in August will be over and above the agreed cut for the month, according to a statement by Iraq's oil ministry. This is VOA News. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is relaxing its advisory for international travel during the COVID-19 pandemic, but just a little. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
The CDC had been urging Americans to avoid all non-essential international travel. Now it says it's fine, but only to about 20 locations. Taiwan, Greenland, and Laos are among more than a dozen locations where the CDC mentions no particular precautions. Seven others, including Thailand, Fiji, and New Zealand, are in a low-risk group. As for the rest of the world, the CDC is suggesting you stay home. And if you have the travel bug, check with those countries' authorities before making plans. Many have mandatory quarantines in place, and some aren't accepting U.S. visitors at all. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Meanwhile, virus cases are rising in France, but the European nation is struggling to administer enough tests to keep up with demand. One reason, many testing labs are closed so that their staff can take summer vacation, just as signs of a second wave are building. AP's Karen Chamis reports.
Doctors and experts say the vacation crunch is just part of a larger web of failures in France's testing strategy, a strategy that even the government's own virus advisory panel this week called disorganized and insufficient. ER Dr. Christophe Prudhomme says one of the problems is not enough skilled workers. First, there is a lack of workers to do the testing. If we don't ask all the health workers to be available by mobilizing all of them, there are just not enough people. The other problem is organization. Prudhomme has called out regional health agencies to organize testing so that it's not the citizen who has to take his phone and try to call 7 or 8 labs in order to get an appointment. Karen Chamas, Lourdes, France.
In Congress, no deal seems imminent as lawmakers and the White House discuss pandemic relief. AP's Mike Gracia has more on the negotiations.
Frustration was evident from both sides after 3 hours of negotiations on Capitol Hill failed to produce a breakthrough pandemic relief package Thursday. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
There's a handful of very big issues that we are still very far apart.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Republicans want a trim package.
When they said a skinny proposal, it was anorexic. And it was not to meet the needs of the American people.
The White House says President Trump is prepared to use executive orders to address some elements of the congressional package involving evictions and jobless benefits. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Over 19 million people worldwide have been infected with the coronavirus. Johns Hopkins University reports those countries flattening their curve of new cases in the past 5 days are the U.S., Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, and Russia. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Friday, August 7th. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for James Butte. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. Zimbabwean journalists speak out against a proposed law that they say would clamp down on government criticism.
Newspapers are not there to be public relations offices of the government. That's not our job. Government should be its own public relations office by doing the right thing.
That was Zimbabwean journalist Sibusiswe Ndlovu. Also ahead, African refugees in Egypt suffer racist abuse. The Gambia imposes a state of emergency to fight COVID-19. South African funeral parlors are running out of space. A newly released opinion poll suggests Uganda's next presidential election is up for grabs. And concerns over a Kenyan crackdown on contraceptives.
What has been proven to work in preventing teen pregnancies is age-appropriate sex education.
That was Audrey Wabwire of Human Rights Watch Kenya. All those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are next on Daybreak Africa. Our top story today is in Zimbabwe, where the government is proposing legislation that would criminalize what it calls campaigns against the country. The government revealed its plan Wednesday after a cabinet meeting. Sthembiso Nyoni, the Minister for Women's Affairs, said the legislation would regulate operations and conduct of all political parties. She also said existing laws will be strengthened to foster tolerance, equality, and social cohesion. It would also ban hate speech in public spaces and on social, print, and electronic media platforms. But some journalists say the legislation is meant to muzzle dissent. Eddie Gondo gives us more from Bulawayo.
The proposed law comes after the spread of Zimbabwe Lives Matter hashtag social media campaign against what critics say has been a clampdown on dissent. Government critics, journalists, and opposition leaders allegedly have been abducted, tortured, and jailed. Among them are award-winning author Tsitsi Dangarembwa and journalist Hopewell Chimono. The hashtag campaign began after security forces blocked a planned July 31 protest march and detained many of its organizers and supporters. South African celebrities picked up the campaign and it has spread globally with over 700,000 tweets. Lofty Dube is with the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe, VMCZ, and said the proposed legislation is an assault on press freedoms and the work of journalists.
We know that this new law they are proposing was spurred by events in the last weeks where people were simply saying that they wanted to put a stop to corruption. But what this would achieve, this would entrench perception that the international community has on the government, that it is a pariah state. What we will see with this law, as we have already started seeing, is the harassment of journalists, the arrest of journalists, the likely persecution of human rights defenders in the country.
Thabani Moyo, the executive director of the Media Institute of Southern Africa, says if passed, the legislation creates a new way to control free expression.
These are quite wide concepts they are proposed. They can mean anything, literally, for whatever reason they want to arrest a journalist or anyone who is expressing for that matter. As a professional journalist, you are easily tipped off balance in terms of protecting the sources of your stories, in terms of your stories being interpreted to mean an attack on Zimbabwe as a country.
Moyo says that freedom of expression, access to information, and the right to privacy are under serious threat. Journalist and media entrepreneur Sibusiso Ndlovu agrees.
It means that we cannot get comments from citizens, we cannot write commentaries, we cannot question what government is doing, we cannot seek accountability and transparency, because once we do that, it can be viewed, depending on who it is, as decampaigning the government. So a headline that is negative or seen as negative can be taken as negative publicity against the government. And yet newspapers are not there to be public relations offices of the government. That's not our job. Government should be its own public relations office by doing the right thing. So they cannot force media houses to do their PR for them.
On Thursday, Zimbabwe's government issued a statement denying allegations of human rights abuses and abductions. It said that highly exaggerated claims on social media were false attempts to smear the country and that freedom of speech is being abused by people who seek to push a sinister political agenda. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Zimbabwe's government to stop human rights violations. South Africa's ruling party, ANC, has condemned human rights abuses in Zimbabwe. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
Amid the long-running disputes between Egypt and Ethiopia over the Nile Dam, African refugees in Cairo say racism and hostility against them are intensifying. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Istanbul with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
300 million people depend on the Nile River to survive, and in Egypt, 95% of the population lives along the river. Upstream from Egypt is Ethiopia. Ethiopia has built a nearly $5 billion dam project it says will provide electricity to 65 million people and help lift the country out of poverty. Egypt sees the possibility of lower water levels as a threat to its very existence. Ethiopian refugees in Egypt are caught in the middle. Taher Omar Huru is an Ethiopian refugee and a local refugee community leader in Cairo. He says there has been a rise in hate speech, harassment, and violence against Ethiopians or people perceived to be Ethiopian, raising fear among refugees. Egypt hosts more than 100,000 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, and many of them say they are the target of open hostility on the streets because of the dispute over the dam. With increased racism, even simple things are more difficult, say refugee advocates. This is Noor Khalil, a legal consultant for refugees and migrants. He says black refugees are commonly discriminated against because locals assume they are Ethiopian and they want to block the water. Online, Egyptians and Ethiopians taunt each other. Ethiopian TikTok users suggest Egypt will be completely cut off from the Nile. Egyptian users retort with posts about Egypt's considerable military prowess. This is Michael Thabet, a Cairo resident. He says the online bickering is fueling growing tensions on the ground. Egypt's critics say the country has long used its power to bully its neighbors and control the Nile. Critics of Ethiopia say that without a legally binding agreement regulating the use of the dam, the country could devastate its downstream neighbors and violate international law. Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan are still in talks, trying to negotiate a deal as the reservoir is slowly being filled up. But sub-Saharan refugees in Egypt say the anger on the ground is misdirected against them. They say, if Egyptians go thirsty, we will go thirsty too. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
Amid a spike in COVID-19 cases, the Gambia's president announced a three-week state of emergency, which began yesterday. The country experienced its largest single daily increase in reported cases this week. The vice president and three ministers have tested positive, but as Pandarium Bai reports, Gambians have mixed reactions to the emergency.
The new state of emergency in the Gambia orders mosques, churches, and schools to close and imposes a night curfew. Essential businesses like food markets, banks, and pharmacies may remain open, but only in the daytime. The government also says markets and shopping areas would be closed on Sundays to enable cleaning or fumigation by area and municipal councils. Ahmed Manjang is a Gambian biomedical scientist who works for the Saudi King Fahad Medical City Hospital in Saudi Arabia. Manjang questions whether the emergency measures will be effective.
We are at a stage whereby the virus has took a foothold in the society, and to control the chain of transmission or infection for this virus, we know is very, very difficult. Even for well-developed countries like the U.S. or the European countries, we've seen that. Sorry to say this, but we are ill-disciplined. We don't like to follow instructions. So that's why I think it's a little bit too late.
Ifi Nyasi is a Gambian nurse in the United States. She says having a curfew is good, but effective enforcement is another thing.
People are given bribe at the airport, said they would escape quarantine. It's just so many things going on. The curfew is good, but they need to have some more plans that they would implement during the day. School is closed. Kids are all over the street. Social distancing is not happening. We have seen funerals of some of our icons in Gambia. And the funeral, you can see people not wearing masks. You can see the government doing stuff that they are not supposed to do.
There are also concerns about how people will get by financially in the next 3 weeks of emergency. Nyang Jai is a Gambian economist.
This has some serious economic implication, especially on the transportation sector and retail businesses. Transporters, basically taxi drivers and others, will be at a loss of revenue because there will be less, if not no, traffic on the road at that time. Supermarket, convenience stores, and other markets that open late will also have a loss in revenue.
Tourism and agriculture account for the greater chunk of Gambia's gross domestic product. Both sectors have been hard hit because of the virus. Farming work would be partially disrupted because of the hours associated with the curfew. The country is also battling with massive youth unemployment. Economist Njai again.
Equally, Gambians are asking who is going to pay for this economic loss or the opportunity cost that would-be businesses would have incurred. Gambia is an impoverished country with a median income of no more than $175 per individual and also having a very large population of people living under $1 a day. So the social aspect of this whole lockdown, it's a cause for concern.
Njai fears that there would be hunger in the country. He says there might be eviction notices for tenants who are unable to pay their rent.
People are calling for voucher systems whereby people will have vouchers to buy food. People are calling for the government to help in utilities and rent. But these are all things that are of luxury because the government of the Gambia is not endowed. But what we know as economists and what we know as observers of the way government does things is that we are in for a long haul. And the long haul is the disruptions that this economy is going to face.
Gambia has recorded more than 900 COVID-19 cases so far, with over a dozen deaths. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
South African funeral directors are battling with a surge in demand as the country's COVID-19 death toll rises. With morgues full, some of the country's biggest funeral parlor businesses have turned to mobile mortuaries run out of shipping containers to deal with the overflow. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
In the South African township of Soweto sits a refrigerated container that used to store chilled goods. Now it stores bodies. Funeral services like Monaheng Lahaye's have had to put unconventional measures in place to cope with the influx of bodies to their morgues as South Africa's deaths continue to rise. Lahaye says he handled 85 funerals in June and 75 in July. That's more than double the number from the same time last year.
We have made sure that we source refrigerated containers to assist us with the current scourge that is happening. We have also made sure that, you know, we spread out our timelines. So if we were just used to burying on a Saturday or on a Sunday, we now make sure that we bury on every single day of the week. So from Monday, burials are already taking place throughout the week until Sunday.
The new arrangements are also proving expensive. The cost of the container, along with a temporary outdoor waiting area and extra staff, has helped wipe out additional revenues. Lahaye says the government aren't doing enough to help the under-pressure parlours. Funeral directors say that beyond the recent spike in fatalities from COVID-19, they have to cope with coffin shortages and delays in death certificates. In July, South Africa had 59% more deaths than would normally be expected between early May and mid-July, suggesting more people were dying of COVID-19 than official figures show. Amid the scramble, parlours aren't always able to balance strict regulations with the expected sensitivity. There have even been reports in local media of the wrong bodies being interred.
Thanks to Lauren Anthony of Reuters for that report. A newly released opinion poll indicates that none of Uganda's main presidential candidates meet the constitutional threshold to win next year's presidential election. The poll was conducted in March before the coronavirus pandemic. It shows incumbent President Yoweri Museveni at 47% popularity, while lawmaker and musician Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, polled at 22%. Longtime opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye got 17%. For more, VOA's Peter Cloti spoke to Dr. Patrick Wakida, CEO of World Research International, which conducted the poll.
If I may ask you, how scientific is this polling? Because I understand some opposition groups, supporters of Bobi Wine and supporters of Kizza Besigye, are kicking against this finding, saying their presidential candidate or aspiring presidential candidate appears to be more popular than President Museveni.
It is okay for somebody to have his personal opinion, but sometimes your opinion or your perception of things could be different from others.
Now, Dr. Wakida, I'm sure you are aware that often the opposition say that the institutions of government are able to steal the elections for President Museveni. This finding shows that that narrative might not be accurate. Is this what your findings concluded?
One very important finding in this research, which people are not talking about, is that for the first time in the polling of this country, you have Mr. Museveni scoring well below 50%, meaning that had election been conducted in March, none of the candidates would have scored 50 plus one, which is a requirement of the Constitution for you to become a president. So the situation would have seen for the first time would have been that of a rerun. That's one. Two, whether the elections are rigged to keep Mr. Museveni in power, it could be true that there is rigging. But there is something you can't discount, that Mr. Museveni, ever since 2016 election, he has not allowed any opponent to go out there. Dr. Kizza Besigye has not done any rally since 2016 election. So the conditions in this country does not in any way allow for opposition to claim victory or even to go and convince people to claim victory.
Based on your findings and the figures that you just spoke about, does that mean the opposition would have a chance to significantly pose a threat to the president if they were to unite in the next year's elections?
Yes, if they did unite, it would create a momentum. Unity would have a momentum effect, and the momentum effect would probably create an opportunity and probably a possibility of overriding and overrunning the state apparatus. It's going to be very difficult.
That was Dr. Patrick Wakida, CEO of World Research International, speaking to my VOA colleague, Peter Clotty. Last week, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta ordered county authorities to carry out a nationwide crackdown on medical clinics that give emergency contraceptives to girls. Emergency contraceptives are a medically safe way to prevent pregnancy following sexual intercourse. But in Kenya, it is illegal for clinics to give the medication to girls under 18 years old. President Kenyatta's orders come amid reports that many school-age girls have become pregnant this year. Kenyatta alleges that clinics offering contraceptives to underage girls are promoting promiscuity and making it easier for sexual predators to take advantage of girls. But there has been sharp criticism of the president's order from some medical professionals and women's rights activists. For more, journalist Maureen Ogiambo in Nairobi spoke to Audrey Wabwire, senior press officer at Human Rights Watch Kenya.
There's been many media reports about teen pregnancies in Kenya in the past few weeks. In April, Human Rights Watch reported about young girls who are being abused while they're out of school during the lockdown. But the Kenya government didn't come out to address the issue at the time. Now, more than ever, children need protection from their abusers. They need age-appropriate sex education so that they know when they're in harm's way. Of course, health facilities should work within the confines of the law, but cracking down on health facilities that have offered services to children will not necessarily solve the problem of sex among minors or predators who are preying on children. Instead, the government should now work with relevant stakeholders to think about how to take care of the pregnant girls, to prevent teen pregnancies by ensuring that children can report sexual abuse and find justice.
President Kenyatta feels that maybe when there will be no contraceptives, the girls will now be very careful and not to engage in some sexual acts. Do you think that this is going to work for the government, or they should just let it be and let the clinics continue offering the family planning services for the underage girls, at least to control the teenage pregnancies?
What has been proven to work in preventing teen pregnancies around the world in several places is age-appropriate sex education, because this education teaches children, it helps them understand how they are changing as they continue to grow. Cracking down on health institutions, pretending that these things are not happening, those strategies are not going to work, because those are the strategies that have been used for a very long time till now, and we are still seeing many teenagers getting pregnant. So now is the time to change tact, to move towards information and also protecting children and not blaming them when these things happen, because when children are growing, what they need is support, what they need is information, they need protection. That is what they need, and that is what will protect them.
That was Audrey Wabwire, Senior Press Officer at Human Rights Watch Kenya, speaking to journalist Maureen Ojiambo. It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports with Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, Jason. We begin the sports from South Africa, where the South African government has approved the return to play conditions for professional rugby in the country amid the COVID-19 pandemic, allowing for domestic competitions to start in the first 2 weeks of September. South Africa's Super Rugby and Pro 14 teams have been inactive since March due to the COVID-19 pandemic. SA Rugby Chief Executive Jury Rocks in a media release confirmed that games will be played behind closed doors. And now to athletics, where Egyptian pentathlon champion Hadi Mosi, who became the youngest Egyptian to qualify to the Olympics back in 2016, made another history this year when she became the first woman in Egypt to qualify for Tokyo 2020. Ahead of the postponed 2020 Olympics, Hadi Mosi says she's looking forward to a different Olympics.
I have 1 year now till Tokyo. My dream is different. Like 4 years older now, so I have to think differently.
Elsewhere, Kenyan athletes heading to the season-opening Monaco leg of the World Athletics Diamond League are scheduled to undergo COVID-19 tests on Friday as part of the protocol to enable them travel to the French Principality for the August 14th meet. Timothy Chiriot, Consenslos Kipruto, Beatrice Chipkoech, Helen Obiri and Faith Kipyegon are the Kenyans invited for the season opener. The athletes are required to undergo a COVID-19 test at least 72 hours before they travel, while they will undergo further tests upon arrival in Monaco before setting their feet on the track. Staying with athletics, World Marathon bronze medalist and Kenyan Amos Kipruto says the COVID-19 pandemic has severely impacted his training program ahead of the 2021 Tokyo Olympics. Amos Kipruto, who represented Kenya for the first time in 2019 and who then went ahead to win the bronze medal in the men's marathon at the World Athletics Championships in Doha, has stepped up his training ahead of the Olympics.
From now is 1 year exactly. So you see now you are aiming to finish the program and come to rest, but now you start now to adjust your mind to say, oh, still have 1 year to train.
In hockey news, the African Hockey Federation has announced that this year's African Club Championship will go on as planned despite the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The Federation released a reverse calendar for the year where the African Club Championship will now be held from the 30th of November to the 5th of December in Malawi. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jason, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great weekend. We look forward to your next report on Monday. James Butte will be back on Monday as your host. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.